Yeah, that was the original piece, is that when I started to do this work, a friend came by the lab and said, hey, why don't we build a small quantum processor? And I said, sure, we can do that. But it's just going to be quantum parlor tricks. It's not going to be, you know, this great quantum computer people talk about. But that was 20 years ago. So now we've moved beyond parlor tricks to having something that we believe is a quantum computer, well, quantum processor. Okay, so today I'm going to start very, very briefly with this, just so that we don't have to interrupt and figure out the notebook later. So this is the first of these notebooks. So you have them now, or? Okay, you will have them. And there's a description of the system that's in more detail than anything I'll cover in class, including, well, that's what the interferometers actually look like. This is about 8 inches, so they're reasonably large. We'll get back to that. The work that we do neutron interferometry work, is done at NIST, and which is in Gaithersburg, just outside of Washington, D.C. And they have a large research reactor, which is located here. And inside the reactor is a cold source. So, of course, neutrons are born hot. We want cold neutrons. And so we send the neutrons into a moderator, which is a variety of cold gases, eventually being cold helium at the very end. This building is the guide hall. So all the experiments are done here. And you can see the size of cars. So this is a quite large building, which is just a big open area to allow us to do neutron optics. All right. And calculate for you the spectrum of those. They'll be important later on. That's a picture of the guide hall. The neutron interferometer is inside that building because it needs to have temperature control. You can read about these things yourself. And then we go and we talk about the physics, which is what we're going to talk about today. And we carry out some simulations for these and set up some simple problems. Okay. So have a, oh, and come on. That's Dima, who was the graduate student and postdoc and now a research scientist who did these particular experiments. Good. So let me stop this so I can get all my boards back. You can look at this yourself. I don't want a lecture from a Mathematica notebook. So I think it's actually working here, they said. So if I say off, everything should work. Okay. So we have our neutron interferometer. It starts off If you could get the lights so that.
Oh.
It's like having a friendly God looking after you, huh? So we have our neutron interferometer. The neutron is coming in. And we're going to define the neutron based upon its momentum. So what we do is we very carefully, in a set of experiments that I'm not going to go over, define the momentum, basically by scattering it off of lots of crystals. And we only are going to look at a tiny fraction of the total neutrons. So with it, from the reactor, in the guide that comes by our equipment, there's 10 to the 14 neutrons per second. And at our detector, we'll have about one neutron a second. So we're very, very selective of the momentum. And so when we think about the neutron, we want to think that we have a small range of momentum. And so there's going to be a wave packet that we associate with the average properties of these. Right, so the wave packet is going to have a width spread. That's going to be roughly 1 over the momentum, scale like that. And this describes, of course, the average properties. And if we looked at the momentum, we would find a very sharp peak. And the width would be about a thousandth of the momentum itself. And the velocity that we are going to look at is about 1.8 kilometers per second. So, you know, these are meandering through the interferometer. So the interferometer is about 10 centimeters. It'll take some microseconds for a neutron to find its way through the interferometer. Now, we're going to use here Bragg scattering. And it's in the Lowy geometry, meaning that we're looking at the forward scattered neutrons. So there's two paths that come out of from the Bragg scattering event. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more, but let's think about the whole process first. And I want you to label these as the eigenvectors of our interferometer. So I'm going to label them. And so the input state is 0. In the way that we'll think about this is that the state will measure the sign of the momentum along the y direction. So if k is greater than 0, and if ky is less than 0, we're in the state 1. Okay? Good. Get that. Now, before we go on and look at this, let me take a piece of the board here and give you a picture of Bragg scattering that maybe you haven't seen before. So if I think about Bragg scattering, you know what happens. You say, okay, I need to have it's always a drag to draw this figure. I should have left the Mathematica notebook up. You've got a set of atoms. And I've got a beam coming in. It's going to interact with these. And there'll be another one coming in. It'll interact and then it's going to get scattered in some direction. And we have to choose so that these, of course, come in phase, that these leave in phase. And that's the Bragg condition. You simply look at the path length and make sure it's in phase. Yeah? Good. Now, what we often forget about in this is that Bragg scattering is, in fact, a coherent phenomenon. So if I say that I have a neutron coming in, then just like I described the paths over there, I can say, oh no, what happens here is I have some interaction. And the neutron has available to it two paths. And every time the neutron impinges on a new blade of atoms, it again has two paths. And so here, we have two paths. And here, we have two paths. And here, we have two paths, etc. And so, what we end up with coming out of this is the neutron spread over this broad beam and that broad beam. It isn't, as I've drawn here, to say, oh, I have one path to the neutron, it comes out there, it comes out there, right? It coherently interacts and is spread. And the width of the blade can be relatively fat. And already, this piece is coherent. So in fact, I never needed that the rest of the interferometer. That if I wanted to look at neutron coherence, it's already there in one blade. And that's one of the things I want you to think about as part of your homeworks, is to say, problem one. And what I mean there is I want you to propose an experiment that can show that even in this arrangement you would have coherence. Now this sort of arrangement, you've been, I hope, you've seen before that if I someday I'm going to remember the name of this. I don't need that one. There's a sieve which is made up of dowels. You drop marbles on there, and at each of the dowels, it gets scattered, right? And if we were using, so we just keep going. And if we were using marbles, then of course, at the end, we would get a Gaussian distribution of this. And you would primarily be scattered around the middle. If, however, at each of these points, I used a quantum particle. And so now you flip a quantum coin to decide which way you go. Yeah? And of course, let's describe the path in terms of the eigenstates of sigma z. And then if I wanted to mix those eigenstates, then a sigma x operator mixes them. So this would have a unitary that looks like right, because sigma x mixes the sigma z pieces, right? And you'll, again, remember you can always say, hey, I don't know that. And We'll spend more time. You'll remember that in SU2, it's convenient to describe a unitary. Like this, where you have a theta rotation about an axis given by that unit vector, right? Good. So if I did this quantum mechanically, then the paths in the middle would see interference effects. But the paths at the end, the path at the very end, there's only one way to get there. So there's no interference effect for the path at the end. And so if you looked at the distribution quantum mechanically, it's a probability, so it'd be nice if it was. You would get something like that. And if you haven't computed that in the past yourself, it's a good thing to spend a few minutes and calculate. Of course, it's an easy thing to do. Now let's look up here. Up here, what you see is that we're going to group, based upon the momentum, all of the neutrons that exit into one of these two states. And so for certain experiments, it'll be important to recognize that there's this distribution, there's this front of intensities coming out. For other experiments, it won't be. Okay? All right. Good. So now, let's continue. So we're back to our interferometer. And I want to describe what happens at this blade. And ideally, what happens is we create an equal superposition in the two paths. It turns out that, in fact, we don't, in general, create an equal superposition because it's hard to arrange mechanically. But we'll treat it at the moment as though we do create an equal superposition. And I'll tell you that this is equivalent to a sigma y rotation. Yeah.
When you say you don't actually create a superposition, does that mean you're close to this unitary?
You know, sometimes we're not so close. You machine the crystal, you calculate what you think the width should be, but at the end of the day, you know, once you've machined it, and that's what you get. We may be 60 degrees, we're never at 20 degrees, right? And this problem of calculating the flow of neutrons through this crystal, that's a problem called dynamical diffraction. And if you want to do it in general, it's a miserably hard problem. One of the things that we've realized recently, we shouldn't take so long to realize it, but we did, is that if I just say that the only thing that happens is unitary, and the same unitary happens at every blade, and I forget about what that unitary is, then it's not so hard to calculate. And so we're rediscovering how to calculate that with a bit more simplicity. It still is, of course, lives in a big Hilbert space. Okay, so we've got this piece. The same thing happens at the middle blade, except I'm going to put a piece of cadmium here, which I'm then going to remove from the drawing. And cadmium absorbs neutrons. So no neutron will get through cadmium. And it doesn't take much cadmium. It's a big cross section. So we put cadmium in both of those places. And we only keep the neutrons that are directed into. In which case, we get the unitary here. Looks like a perfect mirror. Looks like a perfect mirror, not because we got the blade right. Looks like a perfect mirror because we absorbed all the neutrons that didn't correspond to that physics. Okay? And this corresponds to a 180 degree rotation, also about sigma y. Yeah.
So this is kind of experiment on some, like, you don't know exactly when one neutron is coming. So
that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're not selecting on the neutron going into the interferometer. We're selecting on the neutron being seen by our detector, which is a good thing because almost every neutron that comes into our interferometer has the wrong energy to be Bragg scattered. And so they just keep going until they hit the cadmium, and then, of course, they stop. Yeah. So this piece of cadmium gets much hotter than that piece of cadmium. This analysis, this post-selection trick, is really common in quantum devices. And usually we invoke an issue called fair sampling that says the neutrons that leave the interferometer are not special. And we might get back to that someday if you try to describe the interferometer, but you said, well, imagine there's a demon that chooses only particular neutrons to leave the interferometer. What can you then say about the physics? And of course, then you can say much less about the physics than if you say the neutrons that leave the interferometer are statistically the same as the ones that stayed in. Yeah? Okay. So we've got this blade. It acts as a mirror, and of course, the final blade does the exact same thing as U1. And it comes together. And if we just do this, we'll show it to you in a minute, all the neutrons would go this way. And we put our detector here, and we have, as I said, a helium-3 detector. In helium-3, when it absorbs a neutron, it forms a tritium atom. It decays into a tritium and a proton. And both of those are charged species, right? Because there's a lot of energy involved in that capture. And what we measure is we measure the charge on those. So you start off with a neutral gas, put a neutron in there. The cross section for a neutron interacting with helium-3, if it's a low energy neutron, is very, very high. And so if I have a centimeter of helium-3 at a few atmospheres, then the probability that it would have absorbed a neutron in this energy range is virtually one. And so we don't lose any. And you're used to helium-3 detectors. As you cross into the borders at the States, you see these big square cylinders next to your car. And those are filled with helium-3 and are neutron detectors to see that you're not sneaking in any radioactive materials into the States. Good. Okay. Now, it's not enough that we have our neutrons coming out here. We want to do more with this effect. And the more that we would like to do is to put a phase shift here. So I want to delay the neutrons in one path. And I'm going to write it like this. Yeah.
Before we go on.
Sure.
After you put the neutrons through the first plate.
Yeah.
We're separating zeros and ones based on the momentum.
Yep.
Which means that my system has different momentum coming out after the first plate.
Yeah.
That momentum is gone if the other is. What does that do to the superposition?
That's a really good question. And so you say, hey, trivially, we could say, look, if the neutron went through this way, it didn't transfer any momentum. And if it went through this way, then it's like a basketball bouncing off a piece and we've transferred some momentum. And the physics are virtually the same. Okay? And then you say, well, haven't you entangled the neutron's path with the blade, and therefore shouldn't you lose all contrast because now you're going to select out one of those two? And let's say I wanted to say, well, how important is that effect? What should I look at for that? Do you have an idea? So very similar to that, what I should look at is the state of the blade before the interaction overlapped with the state of the blade after the interaction. And if those two are orthogonal, then exactly as you suggest, we would have entangled them. And if we then went through the process and we didn't worry about that entanglement, we would lose all contrast because we would project into one of those paths. But the state of the blade is a really complicated thing, and it is not in any way noticeably changed by interacting with a neutron. And so that overlap is one. But if I said, oh, and one can do the experiment. Let me say, let's make this really thin. Let's make it really, really cold. Let's do that experiment. And there's a number of experiments, optomechanics experiments, that aim to do that. And then, of course, you need to worry about the wave function of that. Okay. So now we're going to put in our phase shifter. I'm going to write this way just to be have a nice, simple description. Clearly, if I thought about this as a rotation about z, then I should have e to the I phi over 2 and e to the I minus phi over 2 there. But I've just taken out a global phase to make it simple, yeah? Okay. And I give you in the notebook all of the potentials. So then I could say, well, if this material is silica, then there'll be a nuclear potential. And we can calculate that. And if you want to measure the phase shift, well, it's easy. Take the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, put in the potential that you have for this material, and calculate the shift of the wave function as it goes through. Okay. Or, you have to compare it to this one, which has nothing in it. Okay, so since you've all calculated scattering problems in one dimension, if you know the potential, you know the answer. But it is in the notes. And let me tell you that 40 microns corresponds to a 2 pi phase shift if the material is silica. Okay. Good. You have to choose your material so it doesn't. And the cross section for silica is quite low. It's not zero, but the absorption cross section is low. Okay. So if we go through this, we say that we start off with zero. It goes through the first blend. We create an equal superposition. It goes through the phase flag. We pick up a phase. And of course, we presume that we can vary this phase by changing the length of that material along the path. And there's easy ways of doing that, but let's not fool around with that. We go through the mirror, and it doesn't do anything interesting. And we go through the third blade, and it doesn't do much. Of course, the third blade, since it's like the first blade, is going to take zero to an equal superposition of 0 and 1. Since quantum mechanics is linear, it better take 1 to an equal superposition of 0 and 1. Since it's invertible, there better be a sign change there somewhere. And so we end up with the state. And then we're going to, of course, now have two detectors. And so the detectors are going to be in those two paths of momentum. And although the beam spread, it's very easy to place the detectors so that geometrically they're only covering one beam and they're covering the whole beam. And so then I can measure the inner product with the measurement operator. And so the probability of observing 0, 0 is going to be, and the probability of measuring 1, 1 And as we would require, the probabilities add up to 1. Of course, they add up to 1 because they're the post-selected probabilities, right? So there, we're only keeping those probabilities that correspond to we made a measurement. And you can see that we would expect, as we varied phi, to have 2 curves, and they're labeled, so. Yeah. Good. So it goes to the bottom one.
Then what's going on? Because if I set phi to 0, I
Well, then I screwed up. What the hell? You know, that's the problem of holding me to any signs. I believe it goes to the bottom one. You can go through and check. I never am able to figure things out when I'm standing at the board. But let's continue, because I want to talk about the physics more than the sign. Okay, so there's two pieces. One, let's just follow up on this. We say, I can take my neutron interferometer, and I can set the phase, regardless of what the choice of sign is, I can set the phase so that all the neutrons come out here. And a nice piece of physics is to say, well, what would happen if I blocked this beam? So I put in a piece of cadmium. So if I look at the intensities at my detector, what happens when I block that beam? So I'll have an equal probability of seeing the neutron at both. You should think about that example, because already this is an example that we can have with one qubit an outcome which is incompatible with probability theories, classical probability theories. And you can work this out for yourself. You say, well, I have two possible inputs to a problem. I've arranged for only one output, and then I remove one of the inputs, but I get two outputs. Okay? So it's easy, even with one qubit, to show that quantum mechanics is separate from classical mechanics. Now let's look at the problem on the block sphere. On the block sphere, we start off in the state, in the eigenstate, zero. So I'll put that up here. And the first thing we do is to give this 90 degree rotation about the y-axis. And so we take that state into an equal superposition there. Okay. And then I have a rotation of, now I know where my problem went. I'll come back to it. Then I have a rotation about z by some angle phi. Okay, so this was the first blade, and this is the phase. And then I have 180 degree rotation about y. So we're going to go over to here. And this is still going to be about phi. So this is the mirror. And then finally, I have a rotation about y of 90 degrees. And so we're going to come back up into the zy plane. And of course here, since we made a measurement, we would see some probabilities of being at zero or at one. And the reason that I ended up in the wrong output is I forgot, when I was doing my analysis, this pi rotation. So you're right, of course. Then we end up with the other one. Good. Now, the way neutron interferometry is used is we would like to measure a cross-section of a material. So instead of putting cadmium here, I'm going to do two measurements with and without some sample. And of course, what will happen is the sample is going to introduce a phase as well. And so what we'll see is we'll see our contrast curve. In the case where we don't have a sample, and I'll put the other one down here. And then this will get shifted over by some amount. With the sample. And so we'll see the difference between those, and the difference we can assign to a phase. And because we know the width of the material, we can back out the cross-section of the material. So we can use this to determine the structures of materials. And it's the most precise way of measuring cross-sections. It's unfortunately never used because it's a real nightmare up until we've gotten things working better. 2 years, and we'll describe some of that in a little bit. Of course, this phase can be from many things. It can be from humidity, it can be from temperature, it can be from a magnetic field of a truck going by, it can be from the gravitational field of the moon rising. And we can fortunately or unfortunately see all of this. Good. Thanks. So the periodicity is given by our variation of phi. So I'm not changing the sample. The sample is either in or out. So if I systematically changed the width of the sample, then it would be in the periodicity, just as you said. Okay? Good. Now, I want to describe what I hope you'll look at in the tutorial. If I look at this blade, and I go back to my dynamical diffraction theory, and remember I said, well, we should just assume that this is unitary without any constraints on it. And then it's enough that I say that it's a rotation about y followed by a rotation about z. You might think, well, there should be one more rotation angle if it's going to be any arbitrary thing. But no, because the state's coming in a well-defined structure state. So all I need is these two. So now I've got my unitary, and I say, oh, I'm just going to repeat this n times. And of course, these angles, since we're interacting with one blade of atom, are really small, right? Okay. So now if I look at this blade is going to end up having some effective rotation that looks like that. And this blade is going to have an effective rotation that looks the same. But the middle blade, we're golden. The middle blade is always going to look like a pi pulse, like a 180-degree rotation around Y. Okay? Now, there's a challenge in that alpha of Z depends on K. And we had a probability versus K that was some piece function. And if I plot phi versus K, it's roughly linear over that. And so you can see what's going to happen. That if I come back and I look at this contrast curve, but I'm averaging over different momenta, then I would say, oh, I'll get a contrast curve that looks like this for some value of K, and then it'll be slightly shifted and slightly shifted again for the different values of K. And if I simply add those up, then the contrast would vanish. Okay? But this is a really quite robust system. So the first thing I want you to do is to tell me why this is robust. Why does it work at all? Okay? So you want to show me that, one, that the measured intensity, the contrast, which is the height of the effective fringes. So if I added these all up, right, they would go to something that looked like this. And so the contrast, that difference, would be less than one if I normalize that to one. So show that the contrast is independent of those two rotations. And to see that, you need to pay attention to the state that you're putting into the system and to the measurement operators. Then two, contrast show that it's independent of those two. And this independence depends upon the value of alpha being the same for the first and the third blade. Okay? And then I want you to look at a new interferometer. I'm going to describe why having this geometry is powerful to you later on. But already you have all the tools to look at it. And notice what happens, that we set up the interferometer so the paths cross. And because the paths cross, the so-called area of the interferometer is zero. That we call this area one and this area minus one because we've changed the way we go around that curve. And whereas this interferometer is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, this interferometer is called a Sagnac interferometer. And it's insensitive to accelerations. So if I want to see gravitational effects, I need to compare these two. But this interferometer doesn't work. And so here we have the same definitions of the blades. And you'll see that you can't have this interferometer be independent of the angle of alpha. So if I wanted to work, I would have to put in a much narrower momentum distribution. But you will be able to tell me how to modify the Sagnac interferometer to recover robustness. So to recover that it's independent of alpha. Okay, so this I would like you to do during the tutorial. I think if you sit down together and exchange ideas, you'll be able to work your way through that quickly. And this year, we're going to do something a little bit different that I want to start the class with hearing from you about your solution at the tutorial. Okay? And then for your homework, I want you to work through this problem of exploring what are the dynamics in a thick blade of an interferometer to show me, one, show that the Bragg is already coherent. Prove that. You could do interferometry with just one blade. And the other piece that we have said here, and you can see it, we've got this distributed beam coming out of this interferometer. We're only going to have any contrast at all if the phase coming out of this is independent of where you are in that distribution. And so show or argue, you know, you don't have to numerically compute this. Show that is independent of which path you actually took. It certainly depends upon which output momentum you have, right? But if you have the same output momentum, which particular path you took, the phase won't matter on that. And I want you to consider that. Now, remember, for the tutorial, you do the tutorial. For the homework, you get to ask your own question. So I give you some to start with, but you get to ask your own question. As long as you have a question, you have some analysis, your analysis answers that question, you go through and you learn something, we're happy, right? Good, we're happy. So wander through that. Are there questions on those two? You might think also, as you come out of the neutron interferometer, this width is really quite big. It's millimeters. And normally we would think that, oh, when the beams come together, we think, oh, they should come together precisely. Well, it's not quite right. I don't need to say that the width of this beam and the width of this beam are this, they don't need to be the same. They are not the same, in fact. And they certainly don't need to be small compared to the coherence length of the wave packet. Okay, so there's some nice piece of physics there as well to say, what's the right way of viewing this distribution of momentum and the spread of paths that you get through an interferometer. Okay, then we'll stop here. Should we stop here? I still have 2 minutes, I guess. We'll stop. Thanks.